Impact of Influence, The Murdoch Family Murders. This is the unfolding story of a powerful South Carolina family, the mysterious deaths they are linked to, and our quest to bring you the truth. Hello, friend, Matt Harris and Seton Tucker. Always grateful to have you join us and spend time with us. How do they find us, Seton?
You can find us on our Facebook page, which is Murdoch Podcast, and on our website, which is murdochpodcast.com.
And please rate and share the episode. We'd appreciate that. And people are reaching out to us, especially about the last episode, as we knew it would be a lightning rod, the episode with Sarah Azari and Jim Griffin. Now, some people asked about some of the questions that we didn't ask. And in many cases, there were questions we didn't ask because there's ongoing litigation that Jim Griffin was unable to speak of, and he told us some of those beforehand. And another reason, because we're not like the in-your-face gotcha kind of show.
No, we're more, we're just not aggressive people, and I think that's sometimes why people choose to talk to us.
Yes. Anyway, I think we did ask what questions I think most people wanted to know. Maybe we missed one. That's possible, but we appreciate you reaching out to us about that. And here's a positive one.
Well, we had one star and five stars, so it was a polarizing episode, yes, as we anticipated. But this review says, Matt and Seton seem like two people I could hang out with. I listened to many podcasts about this whole topic, and this is by far my favorite. The hosts recognize that, just like us, they are human. They also do not claim to be experts and also seek both sides of issues at hand. One thing really made me admire them was their recent interview with Jim Griffin. I appreciate them speaking with the prosecution as well as the defense, because this is exactly what a trial is, two-sided. They are not set in their minds to think one way over another, truly unbiased reporting and opinions. I'm also thankful they skip over exaggeration like some other commentators on the Murdoch saga. Thank you, Matt and Seton.
That was nice. Thank you. This is from Ellen. And she says, hello, I've listened to your podcast since the beginning and appreciate how you seem to value remaining neutral and hosting guests with differing viewpoints. However, in my opinion, being fair host does not mean you have to allow guest airtime to make ridiculous statements in an unchecked manner. I was happy to hear Ms. Tucker offer some pushback when your most recent guests, Mr. Griffin and Ms. Azari, chose to imply that it was biblically wrong for Sandy Smith to choose to exhume Stephen's body. But for you, Seton, for at least commenting that Ms. Smith has the right to do what she sees as appropriate. Mr. Griffin's extreme statement also caused me to wonder why he felt the need to shame Ms. Smith for her decision. He is certain his client is not involved and she is not using public resources, so why is he feeling so fearful? Thanks for the perspectives you have offered through your podcast. I think you'd be proud of what you have created. Best, Ellen. Thank you, Ellen. I do want to explain that, though. I think there was a misunderstanding about when Jim Griffin was talking about what she wrote in the Zima was to imply that it was biblically wrong for Sandy Smith to choose to exhume Stephen's body. That is not what he was saying. They were referring to case law. 1915 was the only case law they could find in South Carolina about how to go about exhuming a body. So he was referring to what was written in the 1915 case law. And it was interesting because, you know, how many states in case law are quoting the Bible and make a biblical reference. It was not his opinion or thought or Sarah's either. It was just something that was written in South Carolina law.
Yeah.
And also, I was under no impression that he tried to shame her. I don't believe that's what he was doing. I think he even said at the beginning how awful it must be for a mother to lose a son. I don't think that's what he was doing. I think we're talking about the case law. And what Sarah was talking was if the body's exhumed, would it prove anything other than possibly could prove murder, but SLED is ruled it a homicide. So that's what they're just all from a legal perspective, not saying anything bad about, she can do whatever she wants with her money and her son. And I'm not sure how it's going to play out legally as far as her getting Stephen's body exhumed, but if she can and she wants to, cool.
Yeah, we're fully supportive of whatever effort she sees fit.
Absolutely. Coming up, we're going to have the directors of the HBO documentary, Low Country, The Murdoch Dynasty, an interesting take. And by the way, we recorded that interview before the Murdoch case even went to trial. We've been holding on to it, but things got so busy. So take that into consideration when you're listening. We want to start with the sale of Moselle, which of course is the Murdoch compound, for lack of a better term, where the murders of Maggie and Paul took place. The property under Maggie's name, 1,770 acre. It's known as Moselle, as I said. It sold for $3.9 million to Jeffrey Godley and James Iyer. And they have not said publicly what they intend to use the land for.
I know that Godley owns a adjacent property. I think it's a farm. So I'm guessing he's going to just roll that into his farming operation.
The property's value was encumbered by about $2 million in mortgages and lawyers' fees and various parties that were looking for money in the various settlements of all the Murdoch mess that was created. So what do we know about how some of that money was divided up?
Yes, Buster Murdoch is going to receive $530,000. There are about $290,000 in estate fees and legal expenses, $6,500 and some change to Laura Jones. I believe she was an interior designer who had a lien against Maggie's estate. There's a little over $12,000 to John Marvin Murdoch, who had advanced some personal funds on behalf of the estate. There is also $100,000 to go to Joe McCullough as legal counsel for Connor Cook to release Connor Cook's claim against Buster Murdoch for the 2019 wrongful death suit arising from the boating accident in which Mallory Beach was killed. We have $275,000 going to the co-receivers, and that leaves a balance of $2.686 million, which will go to Mark Tinsley as legal counsel for Renee Beach, and also Morgan Dowdy and Miley Altman, who all have civil suits in the boating crash.
Now let's move on to the auction of the items from the Moselle property. And Seton, you and I talked a bit. We were kind of surprised at how into this auction the items people were.
Oh my gosh, we've gotten so many questions. It really has seemed to go viral. I mean, definitely some interesting items, but we're going to bring on Aubrey Dempsey, who has been with us before. He actually attended the auctions. Aubrey, welcome.
Hi, how are you? Good to see you again.
Set up the scene. Is it in a big warehouse type thing, or how's it done?
Yeah, it's a big metal warehouse. The front room, as they call it, is all air conditioned. It's got the concession stand on that end. And the back room is another huge warehouse type room, un-air conditioned. And in both spaces, you've got tables just lined up end to end from one end of both buildings to the other. Larger furniture all around the perimeters of the buildings. And also on the one end where you saw the sofa and love seat combo, that all that leather furniture was all on one end together with some of the bigger pieces.
How many people were actually at this auction? Were there a lot of people?
If I had to estimate, I would say it was well into the thousands.
Wow.
Yeah. When I say shoulder to shoulder with barely room to move, I'm not exaggerating at all. It was crazy. I got there. First bidding started at 4 o'clock. I rolled in about 3:25, and it was already getting really busy. But by the time the bidding actually started, it was just wall to wall and warm. It got a little hot in there, as a metal building typically does, and it was just definitely a crowded kind of event.
Wow. So how long did the auction last?
I left there at 9:15, 9:30, and it was still going strong.
Wow.
Tell us what some of the bigger items that sold. I mean, first of all, we need to talk about the couch, the alibi couch.
Yes, that all of that furniture sold. They sold it in individual pieces. I think their theory is they've got more for it that way, but they sold it in individual pieces, as well as the rug that it was sitting on. So everything that you saw in those photographs of the leather furniture, the end tables, basically the whole room, it all went together. It actually ultimately ended up being to one bidder. And he is going to set up some sort of hunt club room with it or something. I can't remember exactly what his plan was. But yeah, it all ended up going to one place, just shy of $35,000 for the whole group. Mm. And that's the bidding price. that's what a lot of people don't know if you've never attended an auction. Auction houses do an upcharge, sort of a house charge. And this particular auction house bid 15% for every bid price. So you take 15% plus another 8% of Georgia sales tax. So it runs the price on up there a good bit.
Wow. So the motif, obviously, people interested in a hunting lodge motif. The things I saw were, in fact, PETA say they wanted to donate it or something. But there was like turtle lamps.
Oh, those were so, they were really kind of creepy to me, those turtle lamps. They had someone posted on Twitter, I can't remember who it was, about saving the turtle population of South Carolina or something. It was funny.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Those turtle lamps, several of us were talking about those, and we think that those may have been leftover inventory from when Maggie had the shop. And that would really be the only logical explanation for why somebody would need that many turtle lamps. I can't think of any other real explanation for it.
Wait, how many were there?
Oh, there must have been 25 of them.
Wow.
They were just locked up, lots of them. And they were selling them in pairs, and some of the pairs went right on up into the couple $3,000 for a pair.
For a pair?
Yeah, it was crazy. And what they were doing with some of those items where you had multiples, like back in the back room, they had one full 8-foot folding table of nothing but deer antlers. Some were, complete deer antlers with the skulls, where they were European mounts. Some mounted to pieces of wood, some just loose. Then they had just ordinary sheds that had been found in the woods somewhere. And so they started auctioning those off, and they would be whatever your bid is, you get choice of however many you want. So that bidding would go right on up. And the first set of antlers went for $475, and then it went on from there. And they just went just one after the other, and then eventually got down to the point where they took whatever was left of the antlers and just held them all up. And just that little assortment by itself was like $125,
$150.
Jeez.
Wow.
Probably one of the more interesting things in the auction was that set of longhorn cattle horns. It's really about the only way I can describe it. It's a set of longhorn antlers that had provenance back to the Dukes of Hazzard TV show. And
that's
so
crazy.
If you've ever watched that, you remember the horns that Boss Hogg had on the front of his car.
Oh yeah.
Apparently this came from one of the props, or was one of the props from that show, and ended up going for $10,000.
Whoa. You're out of your dang mind. Are you serious?
No, I'm serious. It's $10,000.
Wow.
I mean, that's crazy. I was sad when I saw a jeweler found a baby rattle that was Paul's and returned it to the family.
Yes, that's a little bit different. It was not associated with the auction. Those were some pieces that were taken to a antique shop, and I'm not sure of the location right off the top of my head, but they ended up in an antique shop. And somewhere along the way, somebody pulled the drawers out of the furniture completely and found that the rattle had fallen down behind the drawer. So the family had cleaned it out, but they didn't know to look back behind there that something had fallen out. But the antique shop, once it came to their attention that they had an engraved baby rattle that belonged to Paul, they got in contact with the family, and somebody from the family came by and picked it up. So it's back in family hands, as it should be.
That's nice.
Same thing, if the monogram pillows from the early pictures of the auction items, there were some pillows on that leather furniture we talked about that had Maggie's monogram on them. And the family came through on Wednesday night before the auction. They came through to look through everything and make sure that there was nothing there that they wanted to take back where it belonged. And it ended up, they took those monogram pillows. So those are back in the family's hands as well.
And what I heard, no guns were auctioned off, right?
No guns, no guns of any type. There were some, shotgun cases and handgun cases, that type of thing, but no weapons themselves, no.
Any other items that were missing that jumped out to you that's interesting or unique?
Yeah, there were. They had a pair of matching Tervis tumblers. If you're familiar with Tervis line, it's a plastic type drinking cup that won't sweat because it's insulated. They had a pair of those that were tumbler size, so little short glasses, sort of like what you drink, I guess, bourbon out of or whatever. And those had Ehlich's monogram on them, and they sold for $250 for the pair. Another item that was monogrammed was a Yeti koozie that you would slide a can into. So it's a stainless steel koozie that you'd slide a can down into that was monogrammed. And that went for $400. And Maggie's bicycle that we've seen from from pictures prior to the trial, from the we saw it in the real estate listing, and we saw it also in the pictures that came out from the jury visit. Maggie's bicycle went for $900. There were several items that were very personal type items that that fetched pretty good prices because they were personally linked back.
Are these just regular people buying these items, or are people buying them for a museum? Or I just don't really get why people are really wanting these items.
Like, are they murder aficionados? Murder, you know, just really into that kind of thing? Or
there are a lot of people collect this type of thing. You know, they collect items that come from notorious killers or from notorious cases. It's sort of a collector's type group out there, I guess, that gets into that kind of thing. And then there's a couple of museums that do crime memorabilia as well. And so I'm not sure on these higher dollar items what their plans were. I know that Mr. Jennings, that got the leather furniture, I know he said his specific plan is to actually use it. He said he bought it because he needed it. Going to use it.
That makes sense, right?
Yeah, I think most people just wanted to have something to say, you know, I've been to the auction, I had this, and, you know, this is who it belonged to.
Kind of creepy to me.
Yeah, I don't.
I am doing a podcast about it, though. So.
I know. No judgment there, but I don't know if I want that bad mojo in my home.
Yeah.
Yep, exactly.
Aubrey, appreciate it, man. Anything, any place you want people to find you, reach out if you have questions or thoughts or whatever?
They're welcome to reach out to me. I'm on Reddit. The largest Reddit group out there on this particular subject is the Murdoch Family Murders. And then also on Facebook, I'm an admin for a couple of the larger groups on there, Horror in Hampton, as well as Murdoch Mayhem. You can find us on Facebook and Reddit.
Thanks, Aubrey.
Thank you, Aubrey.
Great to talk to you guys.
Thanks, man.
Thanks.
And the second part of this podcast is an interview we did before Ehlich Murdoch even went to trial. So take that into consideration. And here is that interview. They are the directors of the HBO Max original doc series, Low Country, The Murdoch Dynasty. Moore Lushi and Daniel Savan join us. Well, thanks for joining us. We really appreciate it. So we know you guys are busy people, and we're going to get deep into the Low Country Murdoch Dynasty doc. Before we do that, give us an overview of what an executive producer does on a documentary.
I have no idea. we basically, you know, writers, directors, producers, and... I guess an EP is someone that oversees stuff, but...
I mean, in this case of the Murdoch Dynasty, we directed the show.
Okay.
And, you know, and we directed it with a production of Campfire, which is a production company that's based in LA. And it was a hell of a journey, that's for sure.
So how was the Murdoch, was it pitched to you? Did you see the story and went to them? How did it come about?
Yeah, I mean, we were pitched by Campfire and HBO on the project, and they were like, yeah, you probably know all about the Murdochs. Everybody's talking about it. And we were like, yeah, Rupert Murdoch, we know him. Like in Israel, like nobody ever heard about this crazy family from South Carolina. Like for us, it was really new. So we came into it like totally oblivious. And like when we started reading stuff, we were just, flabbergasted. I mean, it was just, it's such an insane story. And so we were really came into it fresh, like it was all new to us.
Well, did you have a hard time finding people to come on your documentary and talk to you because not being from here, was that difficult?
Oh no, we were like on the ground, but I mean, we spent almost like 6 months in South Carolina, just back and forth, and with an amazing production team that was really living on the ground there. But I must say the Murdochs hold such a tight grip on South Carolina that people were extremely cautious and extremely afraid. I mean, in the past, talking to the media or even to your friends, you know, would get you fired, threatened, sometimes even worse. And it was, people were really, really cautious about it, because it's not just talking about influential people, it's talking about your local DA. I mean, it's really, really dangerous. And it's a place where the police and the justice system and the banks hold such a tight-knit connection that, you know, people really needed to think twice and three times before talking to us.
I was going to say, when we started doing the podcast a few weeks after the murders, plenty of people told us to be careful. And I don't know, it was like a threat on our lives, but it was just, they're going to, you'll say something wrong and they might sue you because they're litigation type family. Did that ever come up, the possibility of something you put on there being something that would be a cause for concern legally?
I mean, legal stuff is always, you know, hovering above every documentary production. So we were very, 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 you know, strict about making it all super, super legal. So that was not a real threat. The threats were on the people who talk to us and expose themselves.
Mm. I think that like Hampton County is a small county, you know, and everyone is neighbors, everybody knows each other. And it's not easy, you know, to talk about a family that on the one hand holds so much power, and on the other hand, you know, it's kind of this loyalty of them being your neighbors for so many years. So, you know, I think because it's such a small place, and I mean, and we as Israelis, we totally understood, you know, the culture of knowing each other and coming from a small place that, you know, that basically like your instincts are to protect your neighbor, to protect, you know, the person that has lived beside you for so many years. But I think that eventually people talk to us because, you know, they held so much power and somebody had to talk about it. And especially the Murdoch's victims, and so much trauma and so many victims around, you know, that I think that eventually people understood that this subject has to be talked about, because otherwise, if it would just stay buried in the ground, you know, this county could not move forward to a new place and to a more healthier place, and cannot overcome their traumas. And I think that, you know, at the end of the day, that what drove people to talk to us. And also HBO, you know, has such a reputation of being fair and being honest and doing a show that is not just like, you know, like, really, really bringing the essence of the story and not looking for something just for the gossip of it, but really to bring the essence of the story and the essence of this county that has been controlled by a very, very powerful family.
I watched the documentary. I thought it was so well done. And a few things that really stuck out to me were the hospital videos. I mean, how did you go about getting those?
We cannot say.
That's great.
Sometimes material just appears.
Moving on to the next question.
Yes. We also thought they were fascinating, and God knows how we got them, but they're amazing.
That was something we had not seen before.
Yeah, and you hear this story from so many people. But then you see the footage and it's unbelievable, right? Like Alex and his dad, and yeah, it's an unbelievable footage for
and
sure.
Also, you had the TikTok videos, which really painted a picture as well. Was that a matter of digging deep, or was that they magically appeared too?
And the TikTok videos, just to for our viewers who may not have, or listeners who may not have heard, were from the boaters the night of the accident where Mallory Beach was killed.
Yeah.
I mean, I can't go into like the legalities of it because it all has to do with fair use laws and material that is already out there. But the thing is really, it's just so heartbreaking. I mean, and that's another thing that is important to remember. You know, when we were watching different, you know, news flashes about this story, people were really trashing Paul and talking about him as like, you know, oh, he's this, you know, violent, drunk, you know, teenagers that caused so much harm. And obviously, you know, that may very well be a part of the story. But it's also really important to remember that this is a young man that was murdered. And for us, it was really important not to just paint it as this sinister devil that, you know, intentionally crashed the boat because he had a streak of evil. But in the end of the day, yes, he was irresponsible. And yes, he probably had problematic sides of his personality. But in the end of the day, it was an accident. And what wasn't an accident is someone, you know, cold-blooded murdering him. I mean, he was really butchered. And it's important to remember that although he's a perpetrator, in one story he's also a victim. So it was really important for us to show both sides.
Yeah, and I think also that, you know, in Paul's case, like Daniel said, you know, the accident was an accident. Nobody thinks that he did it intentionally, right? Like he was drunk and he was on a boat, and that's definitely wrong. And that's definitely you shouldn't do. But also we think that, you know, what was so problematic, of course, was how his dad, you know, dealt with this accusation, and how, you know, and what happened after the accident. Mallory was Paul's friend at the end of the day. You know, Mallory was loved by everyone.
Paul included.
So I don't.
And Anthony, I think, you know, when I saw him in your documentary, Anthony Cook, Mallory's boyfriend, really to me brought home exactly the sentiment that you're trying to say, that, you know, he said he actually forgave Paul. They had a moment.
Yeah.
Yes. And I think that's really, you know, the essence of what we are trying to do when we do documentaries is bring a real three-dimensional picture, because Anthony, what he said, and that was really tragic, is that he lost two of his friends. He lost Paul and he lost Mallory. And, you know, when you look at like these small news snippets, it's always about, you know, let's just look at it in a very one-sided way. And like, you know, Paul's a devil. And then it's like, you know, going into this trashing it. But it really is a tragedy no matter where you look for everybody involved.
And I think that the way you do it is a lot more difficult. It's easier to do the one-sided picture podcast documentary without the depth to it than it is to do what you did. And we try to do is paint a picture of all sides' emotions and what the town is going through and that sort of thing. And I applaud you for going into that depth. It's much more difficult to do it that way than to pick a villain and zero in and just slam them.
Another victim that you really gave a face to in your documentary was Stephen Smith. Let's talk a little bit about that.
So Stephen, you know, that is obviously, you know, for us personally, it's the most tragic story and the story that hit us emotionally, you know, the strongest, because every single one of the victims, be it Mallory or Paul or Maggie or others, everybody knows what happened, but nobody knows, you know, how they were murdered, but people have answers. With Stephen, nobody has any answers, and nobody looked into it. I mean, and this is not taking away from any other tragedy, but the second Mallory Beach was lost, media was all over the place. The minute that Paul and Maggie were murdered, media was covering Hampton. When Stephen got allegedly hit by a car, which none of us personally believe, nobody covered it. It wasn't national news. Nobody, you know, did docuseries about it. There wasn't the Stephen Smith podcast. And his family was left with no answers. And till this day, they have no answers. And they don't care if the Murdochs did it, if it was a drunk driver, if it was, you know, a violent guy from another town. They just want answers, and they're not trying to blame anybody. They just want to have, you know, that small, you know, solace of knowing what happened to their loved one.
And obviously, and obviously, you see from the series, from the episode, how the interrogation was very, very problematic, like how they handled the police. You know, and the law enforcement handled
it was for sure.
This investigation was very problematic. And maybe if they would, you know, have really, you know, did their work 8 years ago, things would have been looked different. And Stephen's family would have had answers today that unfortunately they don't have. And if, you know, if it's to learn something out of it, is that this is somebody's son, this is somebody's family, and you can't mishandle an investigation like that. It's you know, it's not fair for anybody.
Mm-hmm. And also, you know, what we really, really wish from the bottom of our hearts is now that the Murdoch's grip is not as tight and they don't have so much control over the town, we really hope that somebody will speak up, because people know what happened and people are keeping quiet. And we are, you know, it's all about someone to crack one day and just, you know, speak out and say, let me tell you what happened that night.
Absolutely. People know what happened. There are some people that hold the truth for Stephanie's pain, to really know what happened to her son.
Yep. Well, you did really an amazing job portraying all of the victims with this saga.
And also, I think that if we know exactly what happened, it will be another, you know, very important lesson of who you are and, you know, and everything that you could learn out of Stephen's story, because, you know, like we portrayed in our series, it's not easy to be gay, in especially, you know, in South Carolina, and, you know, and raising the story and giving it a voice, and really giving a voice to, you can be whoever you want and you deserve everything, you know, like, so I think that also this was really important subject to us, that you could be whoever you want and people will accept you because this is the right thing to do.
Well, the documentary was incredibly well done. Do you think you're going to have a part two?
Who knows?
Like, I mean, I wish like someone would do it. Even if it's not us, I just want to know how the outcome of this trial is going to be, because I mean, honestly, when we were working on it, we were trying to hypothesize, and we threw out all kinds of series of, like, you know, you probably heard them all, about like what could have been the motive for the deaths of Paul and Maggie, and what the prosecutor is now saying, that, you know, he is alleging that Alex killed them just to take the scent off with no real motive, with nothing that was, you know, they went about to expose him. She wasn't cheating on him. He's just saying that he just used his own family as a diversion. That is so incredibly sick that, like, we never even thought about it, because it's like, for us, it's like, wait, that's not a motive. That's just like, that's just evil. Yeah. So, I mean, first of all, I have no idea what will be the outcome. And, you know, we are all, we know, you know, just as much as anybody, just, you know, waiting to see how this trial will play out. But I would love to watch that trial, because it's just absolutely horrible and just, you know, mesmerizing.
Daniel and Moore, we appreciate it. And by the way, I'd loved The Devil Next Door that you also, that was really the twists and turns and the tenseness of it was fantastic. If you guys haven't watched it out there, check that out.
I have not. I'm putting it in the queue.
It's very good. Daniel Moore, thank you guys. Appreciate it.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much
for having us.
We hope we talk soon. Have a good day. That was cool. Get some behind the scenes type thoughts on what going through a director's mind when they're doing a doc.
Yeah, my husband's going to love this episode, because I think, in, you know, if he had to do it all over again, this would be what he would like to do.
Really? Yes.
Yes.
And again, we did that before the trial, so just keep that in mind as you listen to that episode. You can reach out to us, murdochpodcast.com, Murdoch Podcast and Facebook. And also, hardly ever mention it, but I also do a radio show called The Matt and Ramona Show on Mix 107.9 in Charlotte, or Mix 107.9.com if you're not in Charlotte. And I've been doing it for just another 22nd anniversary a minute ago. Morning 6 to 10. So my boss will appreciate me saying that, because often I'll say, I'm leaving work early to go do a podcast. And at the beginning, they're like, oh, what are you talking about?
Yeah, they were nice enough to let you go to Hampton and record from there.
Exactly. All right. We're thankful, grateful, and all that good stuff. And we'll talk soon, friend.